Call them change makers.
Call them rule breakers.
We call them redefiners.
Join us in conversation with daring leaders who are creating extraordinary impact and driving change from around the globe.
Each episode gives you a fresh perspective on your leadership and career journey. I'm Hoda Tahoon, a leadership advisor at Russell Reynolds.
I'm Clark Murphy, the former chief executive officer and a leadership advisor. And this is Redefiners. Hello, everybody, and welcome back to Redefiners. Hoda is off today, so like our guest, I will be navigating solo. Before we get started, I wanted to pose a question. What's the most outrageous dream you have? Is it climbing Mount Everest? Is it base jumping off the Empire State Building? What is it? Because whatever it is, how far would you be willing to go, and how much would you be willing to sacrifice to achieve it? Would you stick with it through the lowest of the lows and when you're faced with the greatest challenges you've come across? In my book, Sustainable Leadership, I refer to those willing to chase after their most ambitious goals as moonshotters. A moonshotter is someone that jumps into action without having all the answers or solutions. Today, we'll be speaking with someone who is the true definition of a moonshotter, someone who's displayed grit and determination like very few people I've ever met, and someone I'm honored to call a dear friend. Our guest and I are both sailors. We've raced the Fastnet race together twice. And for those who aren't sailors, the Fastnet is one of the most iconic ocean races in the world. It spans 600 nautical miles across the English Channel and the Irish Sea. Our guest today is none other than Dee Kafari, MBE. In 2006, Dee set a world record by becoming the first woman to have sailed solo, nonstop, circumnavigating around the world in both directions. She's now sailed around the world six times. That's right, six times. Most sailors dream they might sail around the world once, and about 1% actually do. But Dee's modest. She'd get mad at me if I read her bio with all of her successes, so I'll just pass over that. You all should read up on her on your own. But most importantly, she has signed on to the Famous Project. That's the all-women's sailing group that has set their sights on the Jules Verne Trophy, which is how fast you can sail around the world nonstop, and they want to secure the first world record for the fastest circumnavigation with an all-female crew. Outside of sailing, Dee's passionate about the critical importance of reducing dependence on plastics. She's chair of the World Sailing Trust, the advisory board of Plastic Planet, and a patron of Sail for Cancer and St. Mary's Junior Sailing. She's also the author of her must-read book, and you should read it, Against the Flow. With that, I'd love to welcome Dee to Redefiners. Glad we caught you on land long enough to join us, Dee. Thanks for being here today.
It's great to be here and lovely to see you again and without a wave splashing between us.
I know. So before we get into some of these crazy stories and also lessons learned about leadership alone and with teams, Dee, can you share with us a little bit about what your life was like growing up and how did you get into sailing in the first place?
Well, I was landlocked for a lot longer than people probably realize, because the assumption, if you're going to be a professional sailor, is that you grow up sailing as a kid, working your way through the dinghies, the boats get bigger, the experience gets bigger, and that's how you progress. But I didn't really have that childhood at all. I grew up going to ballet classes and tap classes in landlocked Hertfordshire, which is just north of London. And through my schooling, I always wanted to be a dancer. And then I played more and more sports and realized that it was quite a fickle environment to be a professional dancer. There's no guarantees. And sport had taken over by then. A lot of my friends went to university, so I was thinking, well, maybe I should too. So my father was happy with that decision. But I did choose a degree that had the highest capacity of practical element possible. And I did a sports science degree, and the sport took over the dancing, opportunities arose, and I became a PE teacher. But one of my aspects of my degree through sports science was I majored in outdoor activities. And that was my first real exposure to sailing. And I went up to the Lake Districts and sailed on little lakes inland. And I was at university in Leeds, which is landlocked in the middle of the country as well in the UK. But it was when I went to the west coast of Scotland, the Outer Hebrides, and we went sailing for a week. My biomechanics lecturer that was sailing with us, he said that he saw something then, because naturally, when two boats are going in the same direction, there's a race on. And that was my opinion, whether the other person knew it or not. He was not surprised at all when, after 5 years of teaching, I changed careers and took to the seas and achieved some of my laps of the planet.
Okay, so I've never heard it was the Outer Hebrides for the first week. For listeners who don't know the geography of the UK, the Outer Hebrides is about as far north, as far cold and typically windy as one could ever find.
But it's stunning as well. And it's funny because it's up in the 58 degrees of north of latitude. And it's very similar to where Cape Horn is in the south. So we often liken going around Cape Horn to sailing around the top of Scotland. The experience is quite similar. Stunning scenery, quite extreme weather. But if you get it on a good day, it's magical.
So you're a 27-year-old teacher in Leeds with zero experience in blue water sailing? Really?
That's right. And it was a career change. My father sadly passed away when I was teaching. I was very easily led as a child. You know, I was inspired by everything I saw. I saw people put out fires and I wanted to be a firefighter. I saw people fly jets and I wanted to fly jets. I had all these dreams and aspirations and I said, I'm going to sail in the summer and I'm going to ski in the winter. I had a very rose-tinted view of the world. And he just said to me, you know, are you going to talk about all this stuff or are you actually going to go and do it? Because pretty soon you're going to be too old to do any of it. And I think that's the bit that struck me. I realized then that actually life is short and you have to make the most of it, that there was more to life out there. And I started investigating, then came back with the surprise notion to my mother that I was going to change careers.
And you did. And you went straight into an around the world race on Challenge. Is that correct?
I changed careers, got some qualifications. And what qualifications allow you to do is have the ticket that allows you to get the experience. And that's quite key, I think, because a ticket, a piece of paper is great, but it's only by covering the mileage, as you know, from your own experience, that you start to amass the experience that can handle all the different conditions. But I had changed careers. I'd been a corporate skipper, so taking guests out sailing, giving them the experience of the lifetime, doing some races. So I'd crossed the Atlantic. I'd done my Fastnet. I'd kind of earned my mileage a little bit. And I had an opportunity to be a skipper in the Global Challenge, the Che Blyth race. And that was in 2004. So it was literally 4 years later of my first round the world opportunity. And it was quite emotional.
It had ups and downs, which I, again, many years later, I've never seen you in a down. I'm not sure you have them, but I'm sure you do. But I've only seen you in ups in all seriousness. Describe 4 years in, what is a down in the middle of an ocean and with other people?
I was taking on my first round the world, responsible for the boat, and more importantly, responsible for the 17 people that had paid for the experience to be there. So it's a massive responsibility, and you're out in the middle of the ocean. It's not easy to get advice. You don't really have that support network there. Everyone's looking at you. And on top of that, every 6 hours, you get a position report of how you're faring against the 11 other identical boats doing exactly the same thing as you. So if you're doing really well, everything's very rosy. It's easy to keep people happy when life is good. But as soon as you start losing some miles or you have a mistake with a sail and you've got then to repair something and the pressure's on, everyone looks at you in a slightly different way. And through naivety, I think back then, I was unaware of the skills required to lead a team. And it was probably my biggest learning curve there. I naively thought at the beginning that I needed to be everyone's friend. And I learned two lessons. One, it's pretty lonely at the top. And that's why you paid the bucks to make the big decisions that not everyone's going to agree with. And you have to make those difficult decisions that not everybody agrees with and take responsibility and own them. That's where the up and down. And I always joke and say that's probably what led to me sailing solo the following lap.
So I have always wanted to, but never have, taken a group of clients, boardroom, C-suite, CEOs, or my colleagues when I was CEO of our firm, out on a 24-hour excursion on a boat. Because a couple of things you learn just for our listeners, everybody has a role. You actually have to work together successfully, because if you don't, something breaks, or worse, someone gets physically hurt. This is the reality of Mother Nature in sailboats. Dee, Mike Golding, who, again, for our listeners might not know, is arguably one of the most experienced, respected circumnavigators of the world. He said you were a different person when you came back from that trip than when you left, as it related to leadership and your strengths as a leader. Can you describe one of the low points and one of the high points of that round the world race with others as a leader, as your first time leader?
Yeah, and I remember before I left, he suggested that I was too emotional to take on this role. And I think now with hindsight, looking back, he had a point. He was right. It was quite an emotional roller coaster, which is using a lot of energy that doesn't actually help matters. But back then it was a case of when you're trying to get the team to communicate and collaborate and work together and be efficient, you actually have to have them all based on the same objective and buy into the same cause. And if you start to get a rift or a rumbling, you actually have to address it and not let it develop. I think I was very susceptible to the grumblings, the rumblings. It's quite hard to address it head on, but it does clear it up and get rid of it straight away. And if you do let it continue, it escalates and you get the divisions on the boat. I fell foul to that. But equally, when the chips were down, everybody really pulled together and did well. So there were times where you're like, I'm really proud of everybody and we've really come together. And then there was other times where you felt like I didn't have them and I'd lost that kind of control. It's interesting that now if I was to go back into that position, which I've done in similar ways, but in a different arena, you know, the lessons learned are valuable. You probably learn your best lessons from the mistakes. You know, if it's all easy, you kind of just flow along. But when it goes wrong and you've got to dig deep and it's miserable and you get a bit upset by it, you learn your biggest lessons, I think.
I'm very conscious, not just with you, but with other women, of saying, well, she was the first woman to do this, or a woman who did that many times. Because with all due respect, you're a great sailor and you happen to be a woman. Do you think someone else would have said a man would have been too emotional?
It's really hard, and that line is so fine and hard to define. And we all talk about being sailors, you know, the skills as a sailor, not as a gender. But it does have to be acknowledged. And you're right. Somebody wouldn't have said to a guy, oh, you're too emotional. You know, where is the okay and where is the not? And if a female generally is assertive, it can be considered aggressive. And that definition of where leadership sits and this and the attributes of being a leader, I think they're still different depending on what gender you are. And I think we're getting better at addressing it because people are saying that it's not okay to say that, but it's still quite slow.
When you think about risk-taking and your first solo trip, you were a leader that came back differently than you left. What was it like to go solo and dealing with it all alone? So you didn't have the challenges of ups and downs, but you were alone.
My first solo trip was the emotional roller coaster. So I'd kind of got rid of the man management aspect that was distracting me and I could just focus on me. But actually learning to live 24 hours a day with yourself was something I'd underestimated. I was so busy thinking I'm going to sail this boat on my own without the 17 crew. I kind of forgot of the psychological aspect of it. Initially, I was thinking, and I think anybody that does endurance sports or that kind of really big kind of commitment that takes a long time, a lot of energy, energy has a massive effect on your emotions. So I was crying one minute and I was loving it the next minute. And I had no understanding of what was influencing these emotions that were coming out of me. All I knew was it was using a lot of my energy. So the transition from my first solo trip to the second solo trip was all about the sports psychology, understanding me and how I reacted. 9 times out of 10, I needed to drink something, eat something, have a little sleep, and then life became beautiful again. But it took me a long time to learn that. And now I'm pretty even and I'm almost annoyingly positive nearly all the time.
You are annoyingly positive. There's no question. 3 o'clock in the morning, we're soaked, we're freezing, we're hungry. And Dee bounces down below and says, so, anyone fancy a cup of tea? How are you? It's a true story. I'm not exaggerating. Drive me bonkers, I got to tell you.
But it is meant to be enjoyable. And I just remind you of that. That's all.
You do. And you make it enjoyable because you're a positive force. So interestingly, you've just said something twice. When you were managing and everyone looked at you, you didn't have to be their friend. You had to make tough decisions. It took a lot of energy. And you learned you could have saved that energy. And then in your first solo, the effect on you took a lot of energy alone. And until you had a sports psychologist help you channel the energy. So in both ways, you look at how you mastered energy as an endurance athlete. I find that interesting, both extremes.
Yeah, definitely. And it was no good them sending me a message or speaking to me on the satellite phone saying, well, Clark's going faster than you. Because I couldn't actually do anything about what you're doing on your boat. I could only manage the things I could manage. So it needed a conversation to be, are you happy with your boat speed? Have you got the right sail plan up? All the positive things that I could say, actually, you know what? I could probably put a bigger sail up. You know, I'm good here. And that's now I've practiced it so much, it goes with that positive attitude that I generally have the positive language, and therefore the positive attitude comes as a result of that.
We'll be right back with Dee Kafari, but first, we'll hear from Marie-Osmond Leroy de la Nosmoline, a managing director in our Paris office, who will highlight the gender imbalance in global CEO appointments and also discuss how organizations can achieve gender parity in the top seat.
The world needs more women CEOs. In 2023, only 12% of CEOs appointed at the world leading organization were women. If organizations continue to appoint women CEOs at this pace, it will take 81 years to reach gender parity globally. So, what can you do to accelerate the path to parity in the top seats? While change won't happen overnight, there are steps that boards, CEOs, CHRO can take to make a real difference. One way to increase gender equity in the CEO role is by creating systematic change in the way that succession is planned, managed, and executed. To diversify your leadership pipeline, consider the four elements: assessing for potential, not just experience; supercharging development for emerging leaders; being intentional about sponsorship programs; casting a wider net when looking at potential CEO candidates; thinking beyond command feeder's role, like the CFO or P&L roles. To learn more about how many women CEOs were appointed in your market last year and how you can build equitable internal talent pipelines that can help to rebalance leadership at your organization, click the link to the article in the show notes or visit russellreynolds.com.
And now back to our conversation with Dee.
There's a story I'd like to hear your side of. Dee and I have a common friend, Mike Broughton. And Mike, former Royal Navy helicopter pilot, one of the world's great weather routers. So he would be on a radio or email to Dee in various places in the world explaining what weather was coming to her the next day or the next few days. And he told me he had to give her a report, and then he was going to a mate's, his best friend's birthday party. The weather report was up to 50 to 55 knots of wind, huge seas. I don't know if it was snowing or not as well. And he wanted to give her positive news, so he said it might go up to 50. He didn't tell her how high it might go. But he stayed by the radio that night and never went to the party, even though people kept calling him, because he didn't know if she would be alive the next day because the weather was going to get so bad. Okay, Dee, what is your version of the same story?
Oh, pretty similar, even though I didn't realize I'd upset his party plans. But it was interesting. As his communication evolved during the Southern Ocean, I mean, this was when I went the wrong way around the world on my own, so against the prevailing winds and currents, down the bottom of the Atlantic, turn right, just so everyone can get the geography. So you're going upwind, and as the depressions come towards you, the safest sector is always in the south, and they just seem to be continuous. And every time I kind of got through one, there'd be another one. So every time I thought I could get a little respite, I'd have to push further south, and it just gets that little bit colder. The risk of ice is there. I sensed at first it was like the wind range will be in 45 to 50. And then it was like 44 to 49. And it was just, he couldn't bring himself to put above 50. And I'd be like, I had 55 knots. What were you thinking? And then it evolved to 50 plus. We worked it out that I'd spent, out of 88 days down there, I'd spent nearly 80% at winds above 50 knots. And it's amazing, you get used to it. So I was telling everybody, oh, it was lovely today. I actually took a shower because it was only 35 knots. Now, in reality, 35 knots is still gale force winds that most people choose not to go sailing in. So it all depends what you get used to. I think maybe harder for Mike, just giving the information, not really knowing how I was dealing with it, rather than for me, who was acclimatizing to these conditions because it seemed normal after a while.
The other part of this story that an audience should know about is you're incredibly afraid of heights. And on that trip, you had to climb to the top of the mast to fix something, but your fear got the best of you halfway up, right?
Yeah, it hasn't really helped my fear of heights, that's for sure. It's not a good place to be, and it's amplified 10 times worse when you go up the mast and then there's no one left on the deck to look after you or control the boat. So now you're relying on equipment to be driving the boat while you're fixing something up the mast. And sailboats to this day still have really intricate electronic pieces at the top of the mast that when you're in a lightning storm often get struck and often need to be replaced. Now imagine you've got a mast that's two stories high, swinging around in the breeze, even in a gentle sea state, that movement is exaggerated at the top of the mast. And as you go up the mast, there's a moment on the rope that you're going up where in the middle, you've got the least kind of traction on it. You're not at the bottom where it's quite tight or at the top where it feels quite tight. You're in this middle section. And it was there that I got stuck. I'd literally just jammed the system that I was using to go up the mast. So my koala impression was doing really well. And you kind of look around and I had a little cry to myself and I was thinking, well, that's not going to help. I was like, well, what else can I do? And it took me an hour and a half to talk myself through disconnecting myself from the climbing stuff. So all the safety systems you put in place, actually letting that go and getting myself down and then sorting out the mess. And I was so relieved when I did that. I had a really good cry then. And then I was like, oh, I've got to tell everybody, because one of the things you do when you're on your own sailing is you let somebody at home, you send a message back saying, I'm going up the mast, and you let them know when you're back down again. But I was so emotional throughout the whole trauma, and I'd obviously been swinging around the mast for a while, that I was like, God, they must be quite worried by now. So I did it. And then, of course, the worst thing was I never actually got to the top to fix it. So I still had that job to do. But it's, you know, now I think definitely when you're sailing in a crew, you need to establish that who is that person that's going to go up the mast so I can make sure it's not going to be me.
For those who want to push themselves harder and further than they ever have in their everyday life to achieve a goal, what's your advice to our listeners about taking that first step?
I've thought about this, of what made me do it, because I didn't have the answers. I didn't know I could do it. And I possibly didn't think it all through fully, but maybe that was one of the answers, as in don't overthink it. And surround yourself with people that support you getting there or want you to achieve, because it's really hard to do stuff on your own. You need a network of people that you can draw on to help you get there. And I think once everybody is around you, you suddenly look and you think, well, they all believe in me, so I need to believe in myself. And it does help your self-belief and your self-confidence. And then you've committed to it. So then you're like, I like to say I'm tenacious. Other people would say I'm stubborn, but I'm definitely not going to let myself down once I've committed to it. And I find the other thing, if I put it out there, if I say it out loud, it becomes real. If it's just an inner dialogue in your mind, you can talk yourself out of it because no one knows. So you don't have to admit failure. But if you put it out there, then you kind of got to find the pathway to get yourself there. And I think that really helps.
Talk about exhaustion as a business leader, as well as the physical exhaustion on boats. How do you think about stamina, exhaustion, sleep, et cetera?
I think it's really important that you learn to understand yourself, what works for you and what doesn't. And what works for one person might not necessarily work for everyone, but you try and make it work to your advantage. So flying into New York, I was waking up at 4 o'clock in the morning thinking, oh, my day started really early, but I'd go for a run, get the fresh air, make me feel better, have a little stretch, go for a nice breakfast. And I had that routine that actually helped me feel better about myself, and I managed the conditions. And it is easy to get fatigue, but I think if you can eat right, drink right, like do the best you can for yourself, you can manage that. And I think if I go to the extremes where I'm sailing and people's lives are relying on me or my life's in my hands, it's that commitment of the storm won't last forever. It will pass. I will come out of this, but actually I'm responsible and I've got to be responsible in this scenario because it's pretty bad. And, you know, I've got to step up here.
When you're on teams now, as opposed to some of the reflections earlier about the first go round, and there's underperformers or someone may not be as educated, but there's urgency, there's danger, there's risk. How do you lead if someone's not pulling their weight or isn't as experienced, but yet you might have a dangerous situation?
They need to be managed a little bit differently. So if it is a dangerous situation, you need to, number one, at all times, make sure everyone's safe. So if they shouldn't be involved at all, then you need to extract them from that situation until it's in a position where you can involve them again. If it's not dangerous, but they're underperforming or they don't know what they're doing or they need some guidance, yeah, I see that as one of my roles to help develop the sailors around me as well. And you put them in a role where you can keep an eye on, or it's quite a simple job that you need them to do, and then you give them the confidence to do that. And I think it's really important that everyone's experience or contribution is a positive one. So they feel that they've positively contributed and they're valued. And that helps their self-belief and self-confidence. So it helps them develop in their progress.
As we do with every episode, we'd like our guests to share a redefining moment. Dee, looking back at your experiences throughout your sailing career, is there a redefining moment for you?
I thought about this in advance of this conversation, and I was struggling because I think there's many, and it's almost like these are opportunities to redefine myself all the time. I've learned so many things that I want to put it into practice and step up to the next level. So I feel like I'm constantly redefining myself.
Not many people have heard of the Jules Verne. Can you just give 60 seconds about what this is and what it means in the history of sailing, this concept?
Now, the Jules Verne Trophy, quite simply, is the fastest lap of the planet. You choose the boat, you choose the team, you choose the weather window. You have to start at the Ushant Lighthouse in the north corner of France. You go down the Atlantic, round Antarctica, back up and cross the finish line. And at the moment, the record stands at 40 days, 23 hours. And that stood for 7 years now. The famous project that I'm now part of has got possession of the boat that did that record. And we're going to see if we can do it.
Every listener needs to follow it. It's in 2025. Is that correct?
That's correct. Yes. So the boat's in the shed now getting worked on, and we're training on a 70-foot trimaran, which is a little more on the edge. It's very responsive. So we're almost training hard to race easy. That's the theory. The big boat, 100-foot trimaran, will come out the shed. And so we'll have 18 months to set some records, do some training and prepare ourselves. And we're looking to go for the Jules Verne Trophy in the winter of 2025.
I'd love to talk about nonverbal communication and the importance of it in your mind, especially as a leader.
I think it's quite hard in the sailing environment. You've got so many layers on, so many obstacles to our eyes and our facial expressions. And even our body language, sometimes it can be misleading, and that miscommunication is sometimes the issue on boats. But I think all teams need to feel optimistic, they need to feel empowered, and they need to feel that they're trusted to do their job. And if you can give them that environment, then they thrive. But as a leader, you have to sometimes be a bit of a swan, paddle like mad underneath, but look serene and happy on the top.
Dee, every episode of Redefiners, we'd love to end with some rapid-fire questions. All you need to do is answer with the first thing that pops into your head. Are you ready?
So long as the answer is Haribo, yes.
Yeah. So for those who don't travel in England, she likes Haribo candy, and she had a lot of it in the boat. Her pockets were full of it. I have no candy. I'm sorry. Okay, first question. What would you be doing if you were not sailing?
A paramedic.
You're forced into a cooking competition at sea. What are you going to make?
Oh, I'm rubbish at that. Pasta. It'd be pasta, some form of pasta.
What's the best surprise you've ever received?
Clean pants in the Southern Ocean.
If your dog Jack could give us some inside information about you, what would he tell us?
That I don't smell the same when I come from an offshore.
Yeah, Jack probably runs the other way.
He recognizes the voice, but he definitely doesn't like the smell.
What's your go-to routine that keeps you grounded?
Fresh air. A little bit of me time and surrounding myself with supportive, loving people.
That's a recipe for all of us. Last one. If you could pick the crew of anyone alive or dead, and they have no sailing experience, they're just there because of who they are, who would you pick to join the boat?
The Murphy clan, without question. I'll take you all.
I did not pay for that response, I promise you, but the Murphy clan will be very happy to hear it. Dee, we can't thank you enough. And there's so much to take away from this. I start with the fact that just go do it. You are the epitome of go do it, whether it was your father's encouragement and your own self-starting, get on with it. And you learned early on that leading, as we all do, mostly in our offices, not in the blue water of the Southern Ocean, the responsibility as a leader when everybody looks at you, particularly if you fall behind, that your learnings are, whether you're winning or losing, you can't be everyone's friend as a leader, and you're expected to make tough decisions, and you need to. And having been told you were too emotional to lead, which would drive many people crazy, You talked about the energy that's wasted thinking about that and learning to lead. But at the end of the day, when the chips are down, people do come together, even if there was rumbling. And that's the most exciting part, just like us leading teams in offices. At other times, as they fall apart, one can lose control. So learn from the mistakes as a young leader, as you did, because when it's good news, you're probably not going to learn. So take the risk to learn from mistakes. You also dealt with, as a solo sailor, the emotional roller coaster, which also took your energy. The sports psychologist talked about not using negative language, only use positive language, what we can do, not what we're afraid might happen. So be positive as you make decisions. And for me, witnessing your positivity at 3 or 4 in the morning and in a huge storm, I could see it firsthand. When you were around the world, you said, listen, I'm not going to overthink this, but I'm also going to surround myself with people who support me, who come tell me what can happen, not what cannot happen. And while you're tenacious or even called stubborn sometimes, you take positivity to find the pathway forward. As a leader, you talked about making sure that things are safe. And if it isn't safe, extract underperformers or those who don't know as well to make sure you get done what needs to get done in a dangerous or high-risk situation. And then over time, if it's not high risk, give them confidence that they have a positive contribution and they'll gain experiences as you did as well. And as a great leader, we often forget the nonverbal communications, and you think it's the most important of anything, which I find intriguing. Your face shows everything, and if you're on edge, people will lose confidence. So Dee, thank you so much for being with us today. A lot of lessons about leadership, about reflection, confidence, risk-taking. Cannot thank you enough. And all of your races, we wish you well, but you need to get to Jules Verne at 39 days. We're with you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Dee.
Thanks for joining us on this episode of Redefiners. For more compelling insights from leaders across industries and around the world, listen to Redefiners wherever you get your podcasts.
To learn more or get in contact with us, follow Redefiners Podcast on Instagram. Find Russell Reynolds Associates on LinkedIn, X, and YouTube, and visit our website at russellreynolds.com.